On May 7th, 1931, you had the climax of one of the most sensational manhunts in New York City history, at least up to that point. They had the famous and notorious gangster known as Two Gun Crowley trapped in a West End apartment, his girlfriend's apartment. 150 police, local law enforcement, FBI personnel surrounded the building. He was up on the upper floor. They'd cut through the roof. They'd done all kinds of things. They were in buildings that surrounded the apartment building where he was, firing shots repeatedly into the building. Not long before this particular attempt to arrest him, and he was finally arrested, he and his girlfriend had been parked along a deserted road in Long Island. A couple of policemen pulled up, got out just to kind of see if anything was wrong, walked up to the window and asked him what they were doing, and then asked to see his license. Two Gun, instead of giving him his license, acted like he was reaching for his license, and instead he pulled out a .38 Special and he started firing into the body of the police officer. After he had shot him and the policeman had fallen, he started to pull off. He then stopped, got out of the car, walked over, picked up the policeman's gun, and finished him off with his own gun. What's interesting is while he was in that upper apartment, surrounded by 150 people in law enforcement, shots firing through the air, and he's hiding behind a small love seat or a chair, a couch, or something along those lines, he wrote a note and stuck it inside his coat pocket. In fact, when they arrested him, it was stained with his blood. And here's what he said. He said, "Under my coat is a weary heart, but a kind one. One that would not do anybody any harm." He was later arrested, sentenced to death, was later in 1932 executed at Sing Sing. When he actually showed up at the big house, his comment was, "Well, this is what I get for defending myself." The notorious gangster Al Capone once said, "I've spent the best years of my life giving people the lighter pleasures, and all I get is abuse, the existence of a hunted man." Just think about those statements by those two gangsters. These are men who live their lives taking from others, brutally murdering anybody who would step into their path. And yet they would look at their lives and say, "You know, I just tried to help people. Deep down inside, I was just a kind and good person. I wouldn't hurt anybody. Oh, I was just defending myself." I think most of us, as we think about what those guys say, we say, "You've got to be kidding. Where is their kindness in what you did to that police officer? Where is their goodness in all the evil and terrible things that you've done in your lives? How can you sit there or stand there? How dare you say that you are innocent?" But you know, those guys are not so different from most of us. They are different, I think, in the things they've done. I hope nobody in this room has killed anybody or done those kinds of things. But there's one area in which they may be like us. And that is, we're unwilling to admit when it's our fault. We're unwilling to take responsibility for our actions and to acknowledge what we've done and what we deserve. Tonight we're going to be looking at the book of Zephaniah. And I would like us to begin by reading just a little bit from chapter 1. Zephaniah chapter 1 verse 1 says, "The word of the Lord came to Zephaniah." Again, that's Zephaniah chapter 1 and verse 1. "The word of the Lord came to Zephaniah, son of Cushi, son of Gedaliah, son of Amariah, son of Hezekiah, in the days of Josiah, son of Ammon, king of Judah. I will completely remove all things from the face of the earth, declares the Lord. I will remove man and beast. I will remove the birds of the sky and the fish of the sea, and the ruins along with the wicked. And I will cut off man from the face of the earth, declares the Lord." Now, I want us to think tonight a little bit about the man and message of the book of Zephaniah. As you listen to what we said right there at the beginning, you can see that like many of the other prophetic books, it's a book of warning and a book of judgment. In fact, the language right there at the beginning of the book sounds a lot like the language of Genesis 6 when God said He was going to destroy the earth with the great flood. And many times the prophets would speak with exaggerated language for effect to get their point across. The emphasis is on the fact that God in His power and might is going to execute His justice on the face of the earth. Let's talk about a little bit about this man, Zephaniah. We don't know tons about him. He is probably the least written about, the least discussed, the least promoted and praised of all of the minor prophets. If you're just visiting with us tonight, what we've been doing is a series of lessons looking at the last 12 books of the Old Testament. Many times they're called the minor prophets. Again, not called minor prophets because they're minor in importance. All that word minor means is that their books are shorter than what books written by other prophets. Prophets like Isaiah and Jeremiah that wrote long books, their books are called major books. Books like Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi are shorter books, so they're called minor books. But that doesn't have anything to do with the influence of the person who wrote the book. It just has to do with how long it is. Zephaniah is the least known of them. Many, when you read through what folks say about his work, say, you know, he's not a great poet or a great author. And he doesn't have any real original or new ideas. In fact, when you read through his book, it's almost like reading constant quotes from somebody else. It's almost kind of like when you do a term paper. Okay, some of your teachers read, maybe you're in high school and you've read a term paper, and you tell your students that they're supposed to put so many sources in that term paper. Maybe you say, okay, I want you to write a 10-page paper, and I want there to be 10 sources or 20 sources, whatever it is that they're looking for. And so as you go through this paper, you have all of these quotes from other people in that paper. Well, there's almost kind of a prophetic term paper feel to Zephaniah. Because when you're reading through the book, you'll read one section and say, you know, that sounds an awful lot like Isaiah. And you'll be reading another section, you'll say, you know, man, that sounds like Amos. And you'll read another section and say, oh man, he's read Joel before. When you look at the 12 minor prophet books, the first 9 books are written prior to the exile, prior to that period when the children of Israel are taken away as captives into the land of Babylon. The last 3 books are written after the children of Israel are taken away into exile or captivity in Babylon. Now, Zephaniah is the last of the first 9, and I think there's a reason for that. Now, he's not the last one to write. It's possible that Habakkuk, that we talked about last time, that he wrote his book just a little bit later than Zephaniah. Though you're going to find some things in Habakkuk that are very similar to Zephaniah as well. But he probably wrote his just a little bit later than this. But as you look at what Zephaniah writes, I think there's a reason that they put him last of those first 9. Because basically what Zephaniah serves to do is his book basically summarizes the other 8. And that's why I think you see echoes of Isaiah and Amos and Joel. Because what he's doing at the time he's writing is he's taking what the prophets have been saying for some time, not just these prophets who wrote these minor books, but other prophets like Isaiah and Jeremiah. He's taking their central message and he's putting it in this short prophetic book of 3 chapters that came to bear his name of Zephaniah. So he's a nice summary of the first 9, and that's a good one to finish on before we move on to the 3 that are going to take place after they're taken into captivity. What's interesting about him is at the beginning of his letter, the beginning of his prophecy, he lists 4 generations of his descendants. That's very unusual. Okay, if they did kind of a list of generations, 3 is about all they went back, but they went back 4 with them. Why did he do that? Well, you notice there that the descendants that's last in that line of 4 is Hezekiah. Now, it doesn't say it's King Hezekiah, but many believe it's possible that the Hezekiah being referred to is King Hezekiah. King Hezekiah died in about 686. And so, it's possible that what he's saying is,
I am a descendant of the great King Hezekiah. Now that would make sense. It would help to explain why he might have listed four generations of his family, because that fourth guy down the line is a pretty significant and important fellow. And that makes Zephaniah somewhat like Isaiah in that he was a prophet who had royal connections. He's a member of the royal family. And he's got connections to Jerusalem. And as you read through Zephaniah and what he says, it seems pretty clear that he knows Jerusalem pretty well. And he knows the city, and so therefore is able to prophesy about the city. And especially in chapter 2, he's going to talk about prophecies against the city of Jerusalem. It says that he prophesied during the reign of Josiah. Josiah was really the last good king of the southern kingdom of Judah. And he started ruling about 640 B.C., 639 B.C. Again, as I said before, remember with B.C., you're counting downward as you move closer to us. So 639 is closer to us than 640 is. But he started somewhere in the reign of Josiah prophesying. And we know that Josiah died somewhere around 609, give or take a couple of years. And most think, because of the way the book is written, that he either wrote it before Josiah began his reforms or shortly thereafter. Josiah became king when he was 8 years old. Can you imagine leading a nation when you're 8? About 10 years later, when he was 18, he started a series of reforms. Basically, he said, it's time for us to stop doing evil and start following God. And it's very likely that Zephaniah and Nahum, who was another contemporary of his, and Jeremiah, were the prophets that played a major role in encouraging Josiah to make these changes. Okay, all these guys are prophesying at about the same time. But from the tone of Zephaniah, these changes haven't taken place yet. So it's either before the age of 18 for Josiah when he started these changes, or it's in those first few years when he's trying to get the ball rolling, but they really haven't taken hold. So I think somewhere between 640 and 620, he writes this letter. He looks at the evils of the people and he wants them to change. And Josiah would end up listening to Zephaniah and Nahum and would lead the people in bringing about change. But really what he's doing in the book, as we look at the message of the book, is he's warning them of the coming day of the Lord. And he speaks in this terrifying language of what God is going to do. And he's foreshadowing a Scythian invasion, an invasion of the Babylonians. But his language seems to speak to another day of the Lord. In other words, in the immediate vicinity, he speaks of God's judgment on certain nations. And in chapter 2, he lists some of those nations. But the language of the book also speaks of things that are bigger and grander than just God's judgment on the Assyrians, or God's judgment on Moab, or God's judgment on the Ethiopians, or God's judgment on Judah and Jerusalem. But that final judgment, when all must stand before God, that last great day of the Lord. In other words, the justice that God would execute on the nations of the days of His time would be a foreshadowing of the final day of the Lord when He would execute His judgment. Why did I start out telling you the story about two guns and Al Capone? Because Israel seemed to never get it. Okay? They lived in rebellion, living in evil. And they were kind of like two guns and Al Capone. They never would acknowledge how evil they were. They always kind of pointed to, hey, we're God's chosen people. He's going to take care of us. Everything's going to be okay. God's not going to do anything to us. In fact, I want you to notice something that's in chapter 1, verse 12. It will come about at that time that I will search Jerusalem with lamps, and I will punish the men who are stagnant in spirit, who say in their hearts, the Lord will not do good or evil. God's not going to do anything to us, one way or another. Everything's going along. During the reigns of Manasseh and Amon, the guys who had preceded Josiah, they had been wicked kings. But financially, the kingdom did pretty well. And so the guy, everybody's just kind of rocking along saying, hey, the kingdom's prospering, everything's okay. God's not going to do anything. We're okay. We're not as bad as these prophets say we are. And so what Zephaniah does in the first chapter is he says, let me explain to you what you're doing. In other words, he looks Al Capone in the eye and says, let me make a list of the crimes for which you're being punished. He says to two guns of the nations, he says, let me make a list of what you have done that is going to cause your execution. And there are three key things that he lists as reasons God was going to punish the Israelites. Okay? He's trying to help them to see that they're living in sin, they deserve God's justice, and they need to change. So, in verse 4, he starts talking about, I will cut off the remnant of Baal and the names of the idolatrous. And he talks about the priests and their evil. And if you go over in chapter 3, verse 3, he lists the princes, the judges, the prophets, and the priests. All these people that should have been leading this nation in righteousness were leading this nation in unrighteousness. And basically what he says in verses 4 through 6 is that he is going to judge the nation because they worshiped God, but they also worshiped false gods. In fact, don't you notice what he says at the latter portion of verse 5? And those who bow down and swear to the Lord and yet swear to Milcom. They mix their worship. Yeah, they worship God. If somebody were to walk up to a person in downtown Jerusalem, and let's say Joe's in downtown Jerusalem back then, and say, Joe, do you believe in God? Joe would have said, why, sure I do. But if you talked to the same person and said, do you also believe in Baal? Do you also believe in the gods of the Assyrians and the gods of the Moabites? They'd said, why, sure. We could have said, do you worship the one true God? Why, sure. But if we asked them, do you worship Baal? They'd have said, yes. They mixed worship of God with the worship of others. That was the very thing God wanted to stop when He first established a covenant with this nation. What did He say in Exodus chapter 20? You shall have what? No other gods before Me. Don't make any graven images. The first thing in that list of 10 commandments that God wanted them to avoid is the very thing in the end that had become the all-consuming passion of their existence. They mixed worship with God with worship of false gods. They also mixed worship of God with living immoral lives. There seems to have been a real problem of injustice, unkindness, brutality, stealing and taking from others. And notice what he says in verse 9. Of chapter 1. He says, I will punish on that day all who leap on the temple threshold, who fill the house of the Lord with violence and deceit. They might go to worship the Lord on the Sabbath, and then come Monday, they might steal their neighbor's house. Or they might on Thursday kill somebody to get their land and their property or their possessions. I think there's a pretty good message. That we need to make sure that as we worship God, that we're not also worshiping some other things. Because you see, what happens in modern day Christianity is that we categorize our Christianity. It becomes like drawers in your dresser. You know, you got a chest or a dresser in your house, and you know, you got the socks in here, and you got the athletic equipment in here, and you know, whatever it is you've got in the different drawers. And so we classify them separately. And a lot of us do that with our lives. And we do. Okay, here's my Christianity drawer. I pull that one out on Sunday morning. I put on my Sunday suit, and I'm going to go to worship services, and I'm going to act like a Christian. But then when it comes to Monday going to school, or Monday going to work, or when it comes to football practice, or band practice, or going on a band trip, I pull out a different drawer and put on something else. In other words, I'm not the same person on the band trip. I'm not the same person at the workplace. I'm not the same person down at the lake with my friends that I am on Sunday morning. We categorize our lives. We're one thing here and we're something else there. And that's exactly what the Israelites were doing. They had their appointed day, they worshiped God, but then, day or two later, they were doing something totally different. And he says, that's why you're being destroyed. Because you've mixed your worship. Yeah, you say there you believe in God, but you also are worshiping other things. What is it that we're worshiping? Popularity? Power? Money? What is it that has come before God in our lives? A second thing he talks about is the influence of their neighbors. He talks about in verse 8, all who clothe themselves in foreign garments. And what seems to have happened is they allowed themselves to be influenced by the nations around them. And remember when he first established them as a nation, you remember one of the things he said to them? Don't intermarry with the other nations. It's not because they were different in nationality. The issue was not the color of their skin. The issue was that the nations around them worshipped false gods. So he said, if you marry with them, you're going to end up worshiping their gods. And so what happens here, because what you're doing with Zephaniah is you're dealing with the end of Israel. At least the end of their freedom. They're drawing nigh to the days of captivity. And he says, let me tell you why your city is going to be destroyed. Because you allowed yourself to be influenced by the nations around you. I'm reminded of Romans chapter 12 and verse 2, where Paul says to Christians, don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed. And we've talked about before, that word conform, it means to form into a mold. It's like they made a mold and a shape, and they made a mold in the shape of the world and the shape of evil and poured us into it. He says, don't do that. Don't let the world shape you. Instead, be transformed. Go through a metamorphosis. Be radically different. Israel let the world influence them. Isn't that a danger of us today? That we let people around us shape us and mold us in their image? We're so consumed with what everybody else thinks of us that instead of listening to what God wants us to be, we listen to the person who we think is cool or the person who we think can help us make money or the person that we think can get us a good position down at the plant. If we do that, we become just like Israel. And the third thing that he talks about is that they trusted in their money and not in their God. In chapter 3, he talks about the fact that he says they wouldn't listen. Look in verse 2. She heeded no voice. She accepted no instruction. She did not trust the Lord. She did not draw near to her God. And then in chapter 1, in verse 11, at the latter part of the verse, it says, all who weigh out silver will be cut off. In verse 13 of chapter 1, it says, moreover, their wealth will be plundered. And then in verse 18, neither their silver nor their gold will be able to deliver them. They had money. Things were going well. And so instead of listening to God and trusting Him, they trusted the money in their bank accounts. Oh, if there was ever a danger for people who live in the United States of America in the year 2007, that's it. We live in a world that's consumed with stuff, position, possession, and power. We're consumed with how much we can get. And when that becomes our God, then we are destined to destruction. So do you see what he says to them? He says, you're being punished because you mixed your worship with God of God with unholy lives. He says, you're being punished because you let the world influence you instead of influencing the world for good. He says, you're being punished because you trusted stuff, money, and wealth instead of trusting God. My challenge for us tonight is to look at our lives and ask, is that me? Am I a different person on Monday than I am on Sunday? Am I letting my peers and my neighbors and others control who I am? And do I live life to get stuff and let it dictate who I am and where I'm going to go and what I'm going to do rather than listening to God? Have I laid up treasure on earth instead of treasure in heaven? Would you take out your psalm books and turn to the hymn of encouragement? One of the things that Zephaniah does is, he says in chapter 2, in the first couple of verses, he says, basically, before all this destruction I've told you is coming, before that happens, he says, change now. He says, if you'll return to the Lord, if you'll be humble, if you'll obey His commands and seek righteousness and humility in verse 3, he said, perhaps you will be hidden in the day of the Lord's wrath. And then in chapter 3, he envisions a day when God will forgive the people And a remnant of Israel will be restored even after this day of destruction and this day of the Lord. Eugene Land was a self-made millionaire who was asked to speak to a group of 59 sixth graders. He thought to himself, what can I say? How can I relate to sixth graders? These kids are from East Harlem. Most of them poor families. Most of them would never graduate from high school. And so he says, what can I say to these kids? What can I do to encourage them? He looked over his notes and this prepared speech that he had, and he just wasn't happy with it. So finally he said, I'm just going to talk to them from the heart. And here's what he says. He says, if you will graduate, he says, I will make sure that every single one of you has tuition to go to college. Just think about that. Going to a class of 59 people and say, I will make sure all of you go to college. Now, these kids from East Harlem had never heard anything like that. In fact, they talked about it, said, for the first time in my life, I had hope. I had a promise. 90% of those kids ended up graduating from high school. You know why? Because somebody gave them hope. Now, we've got one or two choices we can make in life. We can either be an Al Capone who won't acknowledge the mistakes in our life and the evil that we've done. We can make excuses. We can blame somebody else. Or we can be the person who acknowledges that we're sinners. That we've all sinned and fallen short of God's glory. That not one single person in this room deserves to go to heaven. And when we finally acknowledge that, and through faith in Jesus, give Him control of our lives, then for the first time in our lives, we have hope. Because Jesus has said, if you'll trust me, then I will take you to live with my Father. So we can live in denial and face God's day of wrath, or we can live in acknowledgement and humility, and in faith, respond to God's offer of salvation by repenting of our sins, confessing our sins, and being baptized. We can acknowledge we're sinners and accept His Son, and then have the salvation that He offers in Jesus. Deny it and die. Acknowledge it and have hope and glory. That's what Zephaniah offered the people of Israel. Unfortunately, a lot of them didn't listen. The question is, will we, as we stand and sing?